Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Do you remember studying the periodic table in high school? Your teacher probably handed you a paper copy as a study guide. Today, you're carrying nearly half the elements on the periodic table in your smartphone. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Forget about silver, gold, and platinum. Our high-tech future will depend on elements like lithium, indium, tellurium, and niobium, metals that make our technology work better. And while we may not need much of them in any given device or application, we should understand that the mining and production of many of these rare earth elements is dominated by China. Natural resources strategist David S. Abraham is director of the Technology, Rare, and Electronic Materials Center. His new book is called The Elements of Power: Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Great to be here, Chris.
So we're entering the rare metal age. How is it different from, say, the age of coal or oil?
We're using a lot more elements on the periodic table than we ever have before. If you take the time period between the dawn of time, if you will, and between to the late 1980s, and the time period between the 1980s and now, you'll see there's a great disparity in the resources that we use, especially with these rare metals. We have used roughly four times as many rare metals over the past 25 to 30 years than we've used since the beginning of the time to the 1980s.
What's a rare metal?
A rare metal is a metal that's used in limited quantities, often in the hundreds or thousands of tons a year. And that's drastically different than zinc or iron or copper, which are used in the millions of tons a year. Some of these rare metals, many of us are familiar with lithium because it's in our batteries, or we've heard of rare earth elements, which is a subset of rare metals that's produced in China. And they're they're byproducts of other metals. So they're not mined for themselves, but they're mined after you mine for zinc or copper. So they're usually afterthoughts. And for many of us, we haven't even realized that these materials are in our products and are critical to them, because they're used in such limited quantities. So when I use the term rare, it's often to connotate the amount they're used in total. Some of them are indeed geologically scarce.
So some of them are scarce. They're not necessarily scarce, but they're not easy to mine in many cases.
They're not mined for themselves. So what makes a element or a metal something that's able to be produced is that it's found in large concentrations. So you can take it out of the ground, go through some processing, and you've taken a mineral and you put it into a metal. And that's very easy for copper or zinc. But when you're talking about its byproduct, like selenium or tellurium, in the case of copper, you have to go through a whole new set of processing. And a lot of times companies don't want to process these materials because when you're focusing on billion-dollar industries like copper, you don't really want to focus on metals that you can that are produced in far smaller amounts, and your revenue would be far smaller.
So, David, how have scientists and innovators developed practical applications for these rare metals?
What we've seen is that these newer metals have been just realized, if you will, over the past 100 or 150 years. So scientists have been playing around with copper for millennia. But now all of a sudden, we've gotten these whole new different amounts of ingredients that have just been discovered, relatively speaking. And scientists now have the capabilities to isolate them and to use them in more products. So what you see is that when scientists are now looking for materials that will go into a smartphone, they're able to really isolate a lot of these the properties of these elements. And what we're seeing over time is that not only are we using more elements on the periodic table, we're using them in higher refined amounts and in increasingly wonderful combinations that are allowing us to have our touch screens respond to our finger, or we have brilliant colors on really flat screen TVs. And if you look back, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have that color even in a much larger set. So we're able to harvest the power of these properties at a much greater degree.
Of course, that all is dependent on the people who manufacture the finished goods being able to source the stuff.
Well, what we've seen over, especially since 2010, was an important year, because in 2010, China had cut off exports of these rare earth elements to Japan, and Japan had relied on them for its high-tech components, for its high-tech industries, for its heavy industries, turbines and things of that nature. And in 2010, it was shown that one country can be dependent on another and can put that economy in a tailspin. And there was a fear within Japan when I was working at their ministry that so many of Japan's high-tech companies, Hitachi, for example, were reliant on these metals. And if they couldn't have access to them over a year or so, the companies would be undermined because they couldn't produce the one widget or the one component or the one chip that would be necessary for their products to work. So there became a geopolitical component in terms of making sure we had access to these supplies. And it put on a race for materials, especially for rare earths, and people were looking to not use them. And I think one of the fears is that if we stop using what are great materials, in this case rare earths, which have very wonderful properties for color on your television or for your lights or for energy efficient products, and we stop using them, they're really giving away some of our best opportunities for breakthroughs. Or if one country stops using them and another continues using them, we give up some economic growth to those countries.
Let's talk about some of the other special applications. These things are really in everything. One of the things you write about is the number of rare elements in my electric toothbrush is really staggering. 35 different metals sourced from 6 continents.
Correct. What we don't see is what I found the most impressive thing about these materials is that the products that we use now appear to do, they have the same function. A television is still a television, it shows channels. But the ingredients behind it have drastically changed. The same with light bulbs, which used to be a single metal filament. Now these LED light bulbs are more akin to a computer and use so many more elements than we had for centuries with the single filament light bulb. So there's really been a change in material use. And it's not something that's going away. We have more. We use these materials also. You mentioned niobium, which comes from mostly from Brazil, and that's a steel strengthener. And the reason why our buildings are able to go so high or to protect against earthquakes is because we're using just 100 grams, if you will, in a whole ton of steel. And these materials have drastic properties that can strengthen steel at such limited quantities.
How are these commodities traded?
When you look at iron or oil, you can just go on the computer and you can type up the price of oil and you'll get a whole bunch of graphs and they're publicly traded and the price goes up and down within seconds or faster than that. These metals aren't commodities traded like that. They're often traded in backroom deals. The prices aren't transparent. Oftentimes, it's a negotiated agreement. So these are really specialty materials. And there's a small subset of people out there, often in small companies, who trade a lot of these materials. So larger companies really have no idea where their materials come from because of this one thing, because of this tight-knit community of traders. And the other thing is that they're so far removed from the actual mine. So it's not like a bread manufacturer is getting its yeast or its flour. It's pretty transparent where these materials, where the ingredients come from. But for a lot of these companies that produce cars, they couldn't tell you where the mines come from to make them.
So there might be questions about how people who are working to produce these materials are treated. Is there any way to know?
You see a number. Well, I spent 4 years traveling around from Brazil to Estonia to China, and the processes to get these materials out of the ground and to process them vary drastically. Some of them are some of the cleanest facilities, they're chemistry labs, and they're on the outside appear as clean as you can get a facility that uses acids and tremendous heat. And then you go to other places. I remember I was in China in what seemed like a hut and about the size of a basketball court. And there were 6 cauldrons about the size of a refrigerator. And inside each was bubbling away was this orange flame and some metal in it. And as I was trying to make sense of how a piece of one of those metals is in the iPhone that I was holding at the time, taking pictures of the place, that my nose started to burn, my eyes started to tear, and there wasn't any ventilation. Mm-hmm. And I was just there for a half an hour, but you have people working under those conditions day in and day out. So there are a lot of challenges, if you will, and there could be a lot done on improving the environmental situation and some of the worker situation that people in the supply chain face.
What does it take if I wanted to start up a company that was going to refine these things and offer them for sale? What's involved with getting an operation started, and why does it take so long?
Let's take a look at rare earth elements. They're one of the most complex to extract and to separate. And it took scientists about 150 years to actually separate all 15 or 17 of them, depending how you look at them, from each other. So they're combined chemically very tightly. And there's no cookbook, if you will. You can't take a book off the shelf and say, all right, this is how we separate rare earths. In a lot of cases, or in all cases, if you will, the ore body is unique. And to try and separate this, you have to mix different acids and temperatures. And it's a whole cooking process that you have a sense of what to do, but you have to figure out the most efficient way to extract these materials. And you do that in the lab, but then you have to do it in a pilot plant, and then you have to do it at scale. And the challenges from being able to actually physically do it is one thing, but to do it economically, that's a great challenge. And so setting up rare earth supply lines can take 10 or 15 years, and it's costly. You'll have to raise millions. In some cases, you'll see billions of dollars, and that's a big risk, especially when commodity prices are low and people don't want to be investing in volatile commodities like rare metals.
And if it takes 10 or 15 years, you could get started on something imagining that there will be a great demand for it, and then that demand may have shifted over the course of that time.
What we see in a lot of these rare metals is that the demand is there and the increase is going to be there. But the certainty of that demand, we know that we're going to be using copper in the future, and it's certain. And the prices will dictate, or future prices will dictate, that more supply will come on board. But the volatility of these markets scares a lot of people away. And you're right, we could have one invention that reduces the amount of rare earths or other metals in a particular application. And we saw that with lighting. Fluorescent lighting uses about 90% more rare earth phosphors, the things that help create the light, the pleasing light that comes from them. The fluorescent lights use a lot more than LEDs, but we've switched to LEDs. So in terms of phosphors, there's been a drastic reduction. But when you look across the board in terms of all of the applications that these materials are in, there is a definite trend line, and it is going up.
We're speaking this hour with David S. Abraham, natural resource strategist, who is director of the Technology, Rare, and Electronic Materials Center. He has a new book out called The Elements of Power: Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. We would love to answer some of your questions now. If you've got them, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
There's antimony, arsenic, like aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine, and thorium, and thulium, and thallium.
That was Tom Lehrer singing The Elements. For speaking this hour with David S. Abraham about his book, The Elements of Power, Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. David S. Abraham, would you have been able to sing along with that song with Tom Lehrer?
I love the song. I've never had that serenade been done before, so I appreciate it. He's too fast for me.
If we want to live in a world where we rely on alternative energy sources instead of fossil fuels, many people are really excited by the possibility that we can get energy from infinite resources like wind and solar. But those infinite resources, converting them to something we can use, relies on rare elements.
Correct. Correct. And there have been a number of studies questioning, are we able to produce the resources that we need? Are they enough in the ground? And what I really try and look at is this demand mismatch. And what we see is that the demand in the future, our ability to create new products, and whether it's the smartphone or the tablet, which in about 4 years, 6% of the people owned one. So what you've seen is this drastic proliferation of products. The air conditioners, the radio, the television have never gone around that world so quickly. But at the same time, we're facing a slow supply challenge to create a lot of these new supply lines, as we mentioned earlier, can take 10 or 15 years. So we're now at a point where our technology could outpace our ability to get the supplies when we need them at the right economic price, at the right environmental price. So we face that challenge when we look at green technologies. And there have been a number of studies, and unfortunately most of them are about 4 years old, that talk about what it would take in terms of scaling up to produce some of the wind turbines we may need. And there was a study by MIT in 2011, I believe, that talked about there would need to be a 2,600% increase in the amount of dysprosium that's produced. And historically, over time, we've never managed to increase the production of a certain metal at that rate. Now, some of these rates may have changed over the past 4 years, and unfortunately, there haven't been new studies that come out that I have seen. But when we're looking at an increase in the amount of electric vehicles that the International Energy Agency says that we may need by 2025, and they are looking at something like an order of an 80 times increase in the number of electric vehicles, there are a lot of rare metals in that, from lithium and cobalt in the batteries to rare earth magnets in the motors. And we're going to look at that across the board for a lot of green technologies that scale up in order to meet the goals that they're talking about in Paris is going to be tremendous.
What are the prospects for recycling, particularly in cases in applications where they're used in just really trace amounts?
In terms of recycling these materials, we'd love to think that when we put a phone or a television that we can get all of the metals out. But in truth, when you're talking about half the elements in the smartphone, the best recycling facilities are able to get 20 of those out. But the odds are your product that's in your pocket isn't going to that facility. What we're finding across the board for most rare metals is a recycling rate lower than 1%. And there are a number of reasons for that. You highlight the trace amount. So oftentimes it's not economically possible to pull out the metals because they're used in such small quantities. Other times we don't have the systems in place to separate the components to make sure component X goes to one place, component Y goes to another. Because extracting the minerals, the metals from our iPhones is actually more complex in many cases than extracting it from the minerals from the ground.
Wow. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Patty in Richardson. Hello, Patty.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I really appreciate the thoroughness of your guests and how well qualified they are to speak on their subject. And I wanted to also ask, should we be replacing our C CFLs with LEDs in the home since they have less phosphors.
Any thoughts on that,
Patty? Sure. That's a good question in terms of replacements. In general, I don't know if I would make, in terms of an environmental impact, what you already have in terms of the fluorescent bulbs, they're going to last for a long time. And if you like the light that they provide, in general, it's better for the environment to use the product that you have and you've already bought, because the environmental impacts from the production and the transport to you are often greater than the use, than the environmental impact created during the use phase. So in that sense, I would recommend staying with what you have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Mark is on the line next in Denton. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how are you guys? I appreciate it. Hey, I have a question. You had about 17 or so metals are pulling out now out of the ore and whatever else. Are there more actually out there that they just haven't found yet? Or are they even looking for more? Or is it kind of like a cap where they're at this point?
In terms of the ore bodies, and if you're referring to rare earth elements, that's the amount of the number of element, the subset of elements there that are extracted from the rare earth minerals. So that's a finite set. But in terms of generally extracting resources, we are extracting most of the periodic table for use in some manner, in some way. So really what we're getting to a point now where scientists have the computer capacity, the computer power to really run simulations a lot faster, and that helps identify which material and which grade we could be using. So we could find ourselves producing even more materials that are uncommon now but could be very common in the future.
What kind of application do these rare elements have in military technology and weapons?
Most of our weapons right now are just as advanced, if not more advanced, than the technologies that we have that fit in our pockets or in our homes, and they're critical. So the F-35 is it's almost a flying periodic table. Most of our weapon systems, whether it's in the computers themselves or in the engines. So you have rhenium, which is used in aircraft engines. And the reason why it's used is it's very lightweight, and it's very has a high boiling point, so it's not going to melt in the engine, which is critical. So a lot of these planes look like that they're just metal or they're steel, but they're highly technical. Some of the most advanced products are the metals themselves, and what you see, companies like Raytheon are very concerned about the supply. In one of their magazines, they mentioned that the demand for stronger, lighter, greener, yet less expensive material continues to outstrip availability. So there are concerns that we are going to be at a point where specific materials, and actually we are at that point, where specific materials are made in certain countries, and we may not have the best relationship with them, particularly China.
How did China become such an epicenter for production of these?
There are two aspects of it. One, there's geologic good fortune. So they have the minerals in the ground, and they're able to access them, where if you don't have the minerals, then that's the first step. And the other thing is that there's been a conscious decision by the government to really focus on the materials. You also have to understand that not only is China the largest producer of these materials, they're the largest consumer. So it makes some sense that there's a focus on that. But when you look back at the 1980s, there was a real focus on let's mine what we have to develop and get some hard currency. China needed money for its development, and this was an easy way to get it. What we've seen over time is that they've realized, hey, these materials have value, and we have to learn how to process them. So going back to rare earth elements, you saw in the 1980s, at the beginning, they hardly produced any. But by the end of the 1980s and the 1990s, they were producing most of the world's production. And by the end, they were producing pretty much all of it. And they realized that one thing they should also do is learn how to process them. So if you go up the supply chain, you first have to mine it, then process it, put it into a component and then make an airplane out of it, if you will. And they're slowly building up the supply chain. And it's been a conscious decision of how can we use these materials to build industries. So what they're trying to do with the materials is what they've done with T-shirts and Christmas lights. They've started producing them in such large quantities and being able to produce it more cheaply because of some government assistance to where they start to dominate the market.
Are they doing that at a loss ultimately?
It's hard to say what is a loss, but I would argue, because I don't have the balance sheets, but the initial investment into these facilities had to be quite substantial. But they're also paying an environmental price, and you don't have to go far from today's news to see the challenges that they face. So when I go to some of these facilities, you see the real environmental impact of the production of these, of the things that we use here. And I think sometimes people look at it as kind of an over there situation. But the fact that we're using a lot of these products that are made or mined there, we own some of that too. We own some of that pollution as well.
Talk about the kinds of pollution you've seen. This is not just about holes in the ground and mountains knocked over. This is really toxic chemicals introduced into environments where these things are being extracted and refined.
Correct. Some of them, as I said before, some of the mining operations, the one I was in Brazil, the niobium mine was a wonderful mine. It looked like a country club. It was immaculate. The grounds were immaculate. There was palm trees and it was well manicured lawns. So, but that doesn't mean that elsewhere there aren't challenges. And in southern China, what you've seen is a lot of mom and pop operations, and people digging holes and pouring acid into mountains and letting the kind of the acid leach out a lot of the minerals that they need. And you run into a number of challenges. Obviously, the acids going into streams. In southern China, you can't swim in the rivers, and the fish no longer live there because of a lot of the runoff that they've had. But there's also something about what seems more benign is that the materials themselves, the dirt. If you ever dug a hole and then you tried to put all the dirt back in the ground, it never seems to quite fit.
Right.
Because air has gotten into it. So when they're digging a lot of these materials up, they can't put everything back. And oftentimes, especially in China, they're on mountainsides. So a lot of this just flows into the river, and then it kills the wildlife. So it may not be an acid that's going into the river, but it's the amount of other natural materials that can create some problems as well.
Does the Department of Defense consider access to these elements an issue of national security?
Yes, it is a national. I consider it so, and so do they. They have to be concerned not just with the minerals themselves, but the components as well. And you've got divisions within the Department of Defense that are trying to understand where these materials come from. And if you looked at some of the the documents from the State Department, you'll find out that they assess critical materials abroad, a critical infrastructure abroad. And a number of these facilities are mines. So this is a list that consists of bridges, mines, underwater sea cables. And to know that the diplomatic circle is also concerned about these materials highlights it's not just defense, which is critical, but our national economic security as well, with companies like Apple, GE relying on a lot of these metals. But getting back to defense, yes, it is a critical issue. They are thinking about it. And ultimately, we are going to be relying on foreign sources for a lot of these materials. And sometimes that creates challenges, and then sometimes we work past them. Back in the 1960s, early 1960s, we were building a spy plane that was going to spy on the Soviets. And we needed a material that was very light, heat resistant, and very strong. And we couldn't find a reliable supplier of this material, which was titanium. So we had to find ways to get titanium, which only came from the Soviet Union. So the U.S. government went to work setting up a secret operation to get quality titanium over into the U.S. To produce a spy plane, which would ultimately fly back over their country.
Are there economies in the world right now that we very much consider developing economies, even to a greater extent than China, that are poised to make significant money from this industry?
There are a lot of developing countries that have mineral bases, and they're trying to develop them. And you hear about Bolivia with its lithium deposits, and a number of countries in Africa that have the ability to mine and to open up new mining facilities. But the challenge for a lot of these materials is the processing. And what we're seeing now is China is becoming a lot more increasingly active in the processing area. So it's trying to buy lithium ores from Australia and elsewhere and process them in China. So you will see more mines opening, but sometimes the processing of a lot of these materials isn't done, next to where the mines are.
Do you need experts working in and around those operations, or can you sort of take low-skilled labor and get it done with basic instructions? I mean, how complex is the process?
Well, people say digging is digging. So getting the material out of the ground isn't so complex. And if it's a valuable material like gold or diamonds, then having an individual person who's got a shovel, as you see in some places in Africa or Congo, it can work on a large scale because one person finds one little nugget. But a lot of these materials aren't found in concentrations that are high, and they have to be processed. So one of the interesting things when I was traveling to around the world is you see different color minerals. And the different colors mean that there are different metals in each. And it's the processing that brings them out.
We're speaking this hour with David S. Abraham, a natural resources strategist and director of the Technology, Rare, and Electronic Materials Center. His new book is called The Elements of Power: Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. You can join our conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is natural resources strategist David S. Abraham. He directs the Technology, Rare, and Electronic Materials Center, and he's author of a new book called The Elements of Power: Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. David, what kind of domestic capacity do we have to produce at least some of these highly desirable materials?
The country is so large, and there are a number of mineral deposits out there. There's many deposits. For example, niobium. There's one in I believe it's Nebraska that's trying to start up. We had a rare earth facility in the California Nevada border, which was opened and then recently went into Chapter 11. There are a number of deposits. We're a rich country in terms of resources, but what it comes down to the market. And can we produce them at the cost that's competitive? A lot of times that becomes a challenge. And especially when you're competing against China, as we've mentioned before, with its government support, with a lower environmental standard, cheaper labor. And when you're trying to set up a new mine or processing facility, you have to pay back your debt because oftentimes you have to borrow money to build it. So you're facing a number of hurdles that the producers elsewhere don't face. So oftentimes you find that it's really challenging to get these mines off the ground. And what's really needed is not copying the last mine. It's really focusing on how can we innovate and produce these materials in new ways. Because to compete against someone that's already have an existing mine that has low cost is a real challenge without bringing something new to the table.
Last month, President Obama signed something called the Asteroid Resources Property Rights Act into law, meaning, if I understand correctly, that American citizens can engage in commercial exploration for and commercial recovery of space resources free from harmful interference. Is that really a promising technology for the more valuable of these rare Earth elements or rare space elements?
Sure, Chris. I love these questions that really look at really, if you will, in this case, very far out there options for materials. And you could put deep sea mining in as well. Hmm. And in terms of accessing the materials, the one thing that's easy to do is to access something that's right beneath your feet. You don't need any great scientific advances to dig. And that's always the easiest way. And whether you're trying to set up something, a probe to go out to space to bring a piece of metal back, or whether you're talking about going into the thousands of feet or more underneath the sea to bring up material, you're competing against gravity. The economics of trying to go out there and even just going out and visiting the asteroid to see if it's worth it would be an astronomical cost. And it seems a little bit far-fetched for a lot of these materials. Now, if it were a big rock that was all gold and we could trap it and bring it back to us, that might be a different story. But for a lot of these materials, it's just not feasible at this time or for the foreseeable future, in my opinion.
So what kinds of things can we do to avoid being dependent on foreign suppliers for materials that will be ever more essential as time passes? Is this inevitable?
I believe it's inevitable. It's like oil and gas. We rely on other countries for our material needs. And it's something that can be a concern if it's not managed well. But there are also some great things about these dependencies, that this interdependency of different countries, it reduces the specter of conflict. So when China wasn't exporting rare earth elements to Japan, and I was working at the ministry, I was wondering why Japan would say, well, we can't export our optical drives to you, and therefore you can't make your computer. So there is some understanding that everyone's relying on someone else for something. So I think that does allow for some assurance that things may not get so bad. But I think that it's impossible to reduce our reliance for a lot of these materials. Now, we can produce a lot of them at home. But the question is, at what cost? Again, economic and environmental. We're not self-sufficient on fish. We need fish. We're not self-sufficient on nuts for most of our food. And I don't think we're going to be self-sufficient on minerals, and nor should we.
Is it possible that we will develop ways to use these elements in smaller quantities or get different combinations so that we actually require less for all the products that we think are improved by these?
We will become more efficient, and we are becoming more efficient in using materials, whether it's oil and gas, or if you look at cars, they're more efficient now than they were 15 years ago. The amount of lithium in batteries is getting a little bit smaller in your iPhones. The same with the amount of indium that's used in your touchscreens. So we're becoming more efficient in our products, but they're also using higher grades, higher refined amounts, and we're also using more of them. So if we're going to save 20% of neodymium in a magnet that's in our in the headsets that you wear, but there are going to be more headsets around. So when you've got 2 billion people that just entering the middle class over the next 15 years, and they want to live the same lifestyle we do, that there a lot of the efficiencies have already been realized for a lot of these products. So it's going to be harder and harder to keep dieting, if you will, and be able to have these products working. We're getting to the end of that ability. So when GE was looking around to reduce rhenium, as I was mentioning before, in their aircraft engine, they could become more efficient in the processing. They could recycle what they could. But there's only so much of that you can do before you really start to impede on the product's ability to function. So when you've got the ability to reduce, people are doing it, but there's only a limit to that. And the amount we're going to need for a lot of these materials is going to drastically increase.
There's such an irony that we are producing electric cars to reduce our dependence on natural resources, and yet these cars are going to require minerals and metals and other elements that may be unsustainable in the future, or at least as things are existing now.
As things are existing now. And that's really the key, Chris, is that we have to start thinking about how we can use things more efficiently. And it's not just rare metals, although my book really focuses on that. It's the bigger question. So when I was doing research, I found that the amount of time that a commodity, the life cycle of a commodity, how long it's with us, has really dropped over the past 30 years. When we're churning through computers every 2 years, same with iPhones, and we're throwing them away, a lot of the materials go with them. So we have to find ways to become more efficient. And some of that, in some places, we've regressed. You know, we all know how to change a battery in our remote controls, but somehow we've lost that ability in our smartphones. Why do batteries have to be so complicated? Why does it take screwdrivers and so forth and a PhD degree to be able to change the batteries in your phone? It shouldn't be that way. And there are steps that we can do or companies can make to bring about what's called the circular economy. So we're using materials for much longer, not necessarily recycling them, but reusing them to the best of our abilities.
Well, explain how that would work.
Well, you have a company like Caterpillar, and what they've done with a lot of their products, their heavy machines, heavy industries. And when they've come to what seems like the end of a life for a farmer here in the U.S., they remanufacture it, and then they improve what's necessary, and then they resell it elsewhere. And so the ability to use the actual the structure of the product and resell it saves a lot of materials. And you could do that with computers. When we have those big boxes that are sitting next to the computers, you can update that and put in the next system. So it's how do you save the shell? How do you save what's useful from one product and make sure that it can last longer? Because it's hard-pressed for me to believe that a smartphone only has the ability to last for 2 years. There are certain products, there are certain components in it that may need to be replaced, but not everything does.
So are market forces alone enough to convert the way we consume finished products to a system like this that is more circular, or do you need government policies to encourage or even mandate this?
Incentives help. Mm-hmm. When you can just throw something, incentives help, a focus and having an ethical component it's like trying to get people to, maybe this is not the greatest analogy, but getting people to wear seatbelts was done in large part by kind of guilting people into it. It's not like you have to guilt people into recycle, but one of the things that the challenges of recycling a lot of these electronic products is that people aren't actually recycling them. Most people would have a couple cell phones in their desk drawer because they haven't recycled them. We really have to make this kind of effort to continue to set up recycling systems, not just for paper or plastic, but for a lot of these electronic components, so we can see if we have the materials to do that. But in terms of real incentives, if it's costly to throw away an electronic product, people are going to think twice about it. Or if you have to pay a certain amount of a fee when you buy a product to recycle it and you would get it back, people would be thinking differently. But the companies themselves have to make it a priority. They have to start looking about new economic models to think, wow, like Caterpillar has done, how can we make these electronic products last, just not originally, but also in the next iteration, and how can we make money off it? So it's how do we make money off of replacing batteries, not just selling the actual phone, as we come back to in this conversation.
Could you work that into the price of the product, or would that be a disincentive on the part, from the consumer side?
Well, raising the price of anything could be a disincentive. But it's hard to say that my iPhone, which was $649, if it were $679, I don't know if that would have dissuaded me from getting the phone. But on large parts, there could be that disincentive. But At the same time, if they're able to make $60 for changing a screen or $120 or $200 for upgrading the phone to the next level, and they don't have to produce that, that's $200 of revenue with a few slight modifications. Because in general, I think people would be satisfied with the product that they have in their pockets to last a little bit longer if it were able to maintain the functionality that they would expect.
You mentioned that having traveled all over the world, the sort of cleanliness and environmental responsibility varies widely. Sometimes the perception is from the perspective of the United States that places like China don't care. And yet we're hearing more and more reports that people in China are saying, we do care about our environment. We need to do something about this. Could a renewed focus on environmental cleanliness in places that supply these elements also impact the supply, or will it simply change the way these things are refined and processed?
I think what you see at the top levels that there is this focus on the environment, but when you get down sometimes to the producers or the local governments, there's still this focus on production and getting the materials out. I think it's great that the higher levels are really pushing for ways to reduce amazing amounts of smog, where you can't see the sky. You don't know if it's sunny. You don't know if that light up in Beijing is actually the moon or the sun. So there is a sense in Beijing and elsewhere that something needs to get done. It's just a long, hard road for them to actually make the steps so that the owners of the companies and the local governments are also in line exactly with what they've got going on. But as I mentioned before, you kind of need this moral suasion. You need the government pushing in certain directions, which is helpful, especially in China, to get people in line to focus on making the production environmentally in a friendly manner. But there are also things that you can do with the government in terms of research and focusing on how to set up, how to fund research that really looks into kind of circular economies. And you see that not just happening in the government, but more importantly, happening with the private sector and some NGOs.
In the last few seconds we have, do you have a favorite element from the sort of gee whiz perspective, something that does something really remarkable?
Well, gallium. It melts in your hand.
Oh, okay. Gallium is something you can, like, make a spoon and stick it in a cup of tea and it just completely melts.
Just in your hand. Yes. So I'm fascinated by that, which may have great properties in 3D printing. If you can actually melt the metal at a low temperature, there can be great technologies that come using that. So that's probably my favorite one.
Natural resources strategist David S. Abraham is director of the Technology, Rare and Electronic Materials Center. His new book is called The Elements of Power: Gadgets, Guns, and the Struggle for a Sustainable Future in the Rare Metal Age. David, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Braylon Becton. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.